John for his time. Thankful for a lesson this morning that he pre-recorded a little while ago, and we got to listen to. It was great if you got the chance to listen to it. If not, it's up on YouTube. You can listen to it at any other time. But I'm going to hand it over to John, and he's going to give us this lesson on the liability of the Bible. Thank you, John.
All right. Well, hello, Spokane people. And no, I don't say Spokane. I say Spokane because I lived there for 2 years. I think I mentioned it this morning in the sermon. It was 1984 to 1986. And John Stockton left for Utah, I think, in 1983 or something like that. So that's how long ago we were there, but we enjoyed it. We were part of the Northside Church of Christ. I remember the river there and South Hill and running up there and that kind of stuff. I don't totally fondly remember the winters there, but, you know, it's cool. And, yeah, my wife graduated from Gonzaga. She had me as a chemistry professor. That was kind of an interesting situation there. Anyway, so I'm doing a couple of classes, one this afternoon, one this evening. And this is sort of Christian evidence kind of things to support our faith. So there's a few items of evidence that I would use to support my extreme confidence that the Bible's inspired by God. You can see a few of them. The fulfilled messianic prophecies, evidence for miracles, claims of Jesus. I'm going to talk about that tonight. Honestly, that's my favorite part of the thing today, because today we're going to talk about things that probably is not going to make somebody become a Christian. In other words, we're going to talk about the reliability of the biblical text, and we're going to talk about historical and archaeological evidence that supports the Bible. The reason I prefer tonight's topic is that pointing people to Jesus can help them become a Christian. And I don't think probably that many people are going to become a Christian. Say, we show them the Rylands Papyrus, they're going to say, oh, man, I need to become a Christian. You know what I'm saying? But I think for our own confidence, because there's a lot of stuff out there, people say all kinds of things, trying to cut down our confidence in the reliability of the Bible. So kind of as an inoculation against that, I think we need to know what we're talking about. So I'm going to do two things. You can see the subject in orange there, reliability of the biblical text. So that's going to support the inspiration and reliability of the New Testament. And then the second half of my presentation today on historical and archaeological evidence will be support for the reliability of the Old Testament. Got it? So what about the New Testament? You can see some manuscripts there. On the left is the oldest piece of Philemon from about 300 AD. On the right is one of the Chester Beatty papyri from 2 Corinthians 11 and from about 175 AD. So let's talk about how confident we can be in the Bibles that we read. All right, and so, of course, you understand we are not reading the original, correct? We're reading translations from the Greek. Did you know that we have almost none of the words of Jesus in the Bible? Uh-oh, shock city. The reason is Jesus spoke in Aramaic, correct? And other than a few words here and there, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, and things like that, korban, what we have, even the Greek that we have, is a translation from what Jesus said. But I believe that we can be very, very confident that the Greek manuscripts from which our New Testaments are translated are extremely reliable. I want to talk about that. There are a lot of criticisms that have been made against the New Testament, saying you can't trust it. People have said that the Gospels were written in the second century, and they reflect not what Jesus taught or what the apostles heard, but what Christians believed in the second century. People said there were dozens of gospels, and there's a fight over this. There's a movie, this is quite a few years ago now, The Da Vinci Code, which was the whole premise of the movie was that you can't trust what we read as the New Testament at all. So there's a little thing from the Da Vinci Code, a quote, almost everything our fathers taught us about Christ is false. This is a common thing, especially if you talk to Muslims and Hindus who have a lot at stake in trying to prove that somehow our scriptures are unreliable, because the bottom line is There is no evidence for the Hindu scripture or the Quran like there is for the New Testament, such as fulfilled prophecies. Here's another common belief, and I'm telling you, if you go online, you go to different Facebook pages and stuff like that, you'll see this. Accept it as obvious truth. Constantine turned Jesus into a deity. It was all about power. The early church stole Jesus from his original followers and using the church to expand their own power. Now, I tell you right now, this statement is absolute nonsense. And it either reflects ignorance or, real deceit. I don't know which it was in the case of Dan Brown. Actually, I think I do know which it was in the case of Dan Brown. He's not a stupid guy. He's a fairly educated guy. Here's another common thing. More than 80 Gospels were considered. Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Mary, Gospel of Philip, Gospel of Judas. There were all these manuscripts, all these letters passing around. And finally, around the 4th century, there's this battle, and a certain branch of Christianity won out and they threw the rest out. I want to tell you, this is utter nonsense. And when Muslims say the Bible is corrupt, again, utter nonsense. Of course, I'm saying that, so what's the basis for that? So we'll talk about manuscript evidence. On the right is a minuscule manuscript. On the left is called an uncial manuscript. And it turns out in copying the New Testament in Greek, it's pretty challenging. If you look on the left there, you'll see all capitals, no commas, no punctuation, and not even space between the words. So if you got to the end of the line and you're in the middle of a word, you just continue the word on the next line. This is why when people were copying the New Testament, things would happen like lines being repeated or misspellings, things like that. We'll talk about the supposed 200,000 mistakes in the New Testament. We'll talk about that in a bit. On the right is uncial. They have capitals and smalls, which is easier to copy, easier to get right. But uncial, minuscule writing wasn't used with capitals and smalls until about the 5th or 6th century. All right, great. So we have different kinds of manuscripts. There's papyrus manuscripts on the left, and then a vellum. Now, almost all the copies of the New Testament during the first 3 centuries were on papyrus, which is unfortunate because papyrus is basically like paper. It's made out of reeds from the Nile Delta, and it just doesn't preserve very well. So it's fairly rare to find a papyrus manuscript. Because, you know, paper, 2,000 years, you figure that one out. All right, but we do have a number of papyrus manuscripts. I'm going to show you some of those. On the right is vellum. In the 4th century, because of some political stuff going on between, parts of the empire, the supply of papyrus began to dry up, and they began to make vellum codices. A codex is like a book. Basically, it's a very, very long sheet of usually calfskin, possibly lambskin. They'd fold it like an accordion. So it's not exactly a book, but it would be like a book. You'd turn the pages. All right. And so we have a number of vellum manuscripts. In fact, most of our vellum manuscripts are on vellum, and those are quite easily preserved. A vellum codex from the 4th century, unless you burned it or something like that, it would last. Okay, here's the oldest manuscript we have. This is the Rylands Papyrus. It's in the Rylands Library. It's in Manchester. I got to go to that library. It's like a kid in a candy shop. When I'm in there, I'm like, I can't believe it. There it is. And I want you to get a feeling for the kind of evidence this is by comparison to some data I'm going to show you in a little while. So this is from about 125 AD, plus or minus about 10 years. And you have to understand, the Book of John was written probably in the 80s, possibly the 90s or the 70s. So this manuscript is from about 40 years after the original manuscript of John was written. This is not the original John. It's got John 18, 31 through 33, and then 37 on the front, 31 through 33 on the back, 37. All right, it's not the entire book of John, but this kind of evidence is going to be very significant in establishing the reliability of our New Testament Greek text. Here's another one from the Sackler Library, which is in on Oxford. It's a piece of John from roughly 150 AD. Again, it's papyrus, so it's not super well preserved. All right, John 18:36 through 19, verse 1. This is the Magdalene manuscript from 175 AD, parts of Matthew. I've been to the Magdalene Library. Let me see, Codex. Let me see. Let's talk about. Okay. I'll get back to that. All right. Then we have the Codex Sinaiticus. So starting in the 4th century, we have entire manuscripts of the Greek New Testament. Codex Sinaiticus is a great story. There was a famous scholar who was on St. Catherine's Monastery, right on the side of Mount Sinai. He was looking around for things of archaeological significance, and he found in a trash can some ripped out pieces of a codex. And he looked, and it's like unbelievable. It was New Testament. In fact, it was what we now call the Codex Sinaiticus, which is in the British Museum. I think I've got a page here. I was in the British Museum. I snapped this picture, and then they started kind of yelling at me. Sorry, didn't know. I wasn't supposed to do that. Codex Vaticanus, another vellum codex from the mid-4th century. It's in the Vatican, an entire New Testament in Greek. The Alexandrian, which is was founded in Alexandria. I believe it's now in St. Petersburg or in Moscow. Others, Codex Bezae, the Chester Beatty Papyrus. Now, that's a whole collection. The Chester Beatty Museum is in Dublin. I've been there. It's incredible. There's dozens of manuscripts, some from the late 2nd century, lots and lots from the 3rd century, and some in the 4th century. Dozens of manuscripts from several New Testament books. All right, and then there you see the John Ryland's papyrus. There's a page of Codex Sinaiticus. Here's a page of Codex Bezae. The earlier thing it said 300 AD, this is 350. It's around from 325 AD. Not an entire New Testament, but nearly entire New Testament. Now, to give you a feeling for the kind of evidence we have. See, people try to claim you can't really trust the New Testament. That there's been lots of errors, things lost, it got changed. Okay, so let's look at the kind of evidence we have to support the reliability of the New Testament. For example, let's look at Aristotle. You see Aristotle writing in the 4th century BC. Nobody questions whether physics or the other writings of Aristotle, whether they're genuine, they represent what Aristotle said. Nobody seriously questions that at all. And yet we only have 5 ancient manuscripts, and the oldest one we have is 1,450 years newer than when Aristotle wrote. In other words, from 1100 AD. So over 1,450 years, do you think possibly some changes, some alterations could have come into the manuscript through a process of copying? Just possibly so. What about, say, Latin writers like Caesar? Or Thucydides. Let's talk about Thucydides, the most well-known historian. Thucydides is Greek, excuse me. So let's do Julius Caesar, the Roman historian. We have 10 copies of the Latin of Julius Caesar. And the oldest we have is 950 years after Julius Caesar, so about 900 AD. Nobody claims that we can't trust this. Omnia Gallia est divisa in tres partes, and vina vidi vice. Nobody questions it. The ancient writing we have the most evidence for is Homer. We have a few hundred manuscripts of ancient Greek for Homer, but even those 900 years younger than the original writing of Homer, and yet nobody questions the believability of Homer that is written by representing somebody, maybe not necessarily named Homer, but from that time. Now let's look at the evidence we have to support the Greek New Testament. You can see on the last line, we have 8,000 manuscripts in Greek. And by the way, that's not even close to all the evidence we have. We'll see, we have plenty more evidence supporting the reliability of our Greek text. The oldest is from 50 years. Actually, it's closer to 40 years, but I'm going on the high side here. All right, and people claim that our text of the New Testament in Greek is not reliable. And yet we have insanely better data to support the reliability of the New Testament than any other. In fact, the only other ancient document that we have even close to as much evidence for is, in fact, the Old Testament. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. So why do people question this? Well, that's a good question. A lot of things people will say, a lot of the criticisms are just plain absolutely factually ridiculous. And others are not quite so, but we'll look at some of that as well. Okay, other reasons to believe that this is reliable. Remember, we mentioned these 80 other supposed gospels, none of which are actually gospels, none of which have an account of the miracles of Jesus, the parables of Jesus, the death and resurrection of Jesus. So we have Justin Martyr in the middle of the second century saying there are four memoirs of the apostles. By the middle of the second century, there was absolutely no debate whatsoever that there were exactly four inspired apostolic gospels. Irenaeus, towards the end of the second century, says the same thing. There are four pillars. I'm telling you, this is a fact. There was never any other writing that was ever considered as a gospel for inclusion in the New Testament. That's a fact. In fact, even the Gnostics who wrote some of these second and third century things like the Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Philip, even they did not include them because we have actual canons from the Gnostics. And even they did not include these other letters. They didn't have the nerve to try to do it because nobody would have believed it. So the New Testament canon was chosen by consensus during the second century as those writings which had apostolic authority. What that means, not necessarily written by apostles, but the apostles during their lives said to the church, these writings are inspired and should be used in the church. All right? Like you see in the bottom of this page, the four gospels are the only ones ever used even by the heretics. This idea that there was this competition is simply completely disproved by the facts. Another reason we can accept as fully and incredibly reliable our Greek text of the New Testament is the quotes from it. We have quotes from Ignatius in 115 AD. He quotes from Matthew, John, and Luke, three of the Gospels, plus several other writings of Paul. Polycarp, writing around 120 AD in the very early second century, quotes from Matthew, Mark, Luke, Acts, 1st and 2nd Corinthians. He quotes from two-thirds of the letters of the New Testament. Clement of Rome, writing in the end of the first century, within 20 years or less of when John was written, and within 30 years or so of when most of the New Testament was written, he quotes from 10 of the 27 New Testament books. It's been said, and I checked it out because I wanted to make sure I couldn't just say this, that using manuscripts from the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century, you can reproduce almost the entire New Testament. Now, you have to understand that Muslims and Hindus and skeptics try to claim that, say, Constantine changed the New Testament, or the Council of Nicaea took stuff out, put stuff in, and kind of created a New Testament in order to match their theological perspective. I tell you right now, that is simply not true. That is not even a supportable claim, because we have quotes from nearly the entire New Testament from before that time. So if you wanted to change the New Testament in the fourth century, you would have to burn thousands and thousands of existing copies, and you also have to dig up the other ones that were lost somewhere in the desert that were found later to make sure you change those as well. This is utter nonsense. Muslims say the Bible is corrupt. They'll say there's more than 100,000 errors. All right, well, let's think about that, because we have roughly 8,000 manuscripts. So that means something like 12 errors per manuscript. And this includes words repeated, lines skipped, errors that are easily corrected by comparison to the thousands of other manuscripts. Virtually all of these supposed 200,000 errors are minor things like a letter misplaced, a word switched, a line skipped, things like that. There's a very, very short list of actual possible changes that came into the New Testament that there's maybe some possible question. John 5, 3 through 4, with the angel stirring the waters there, that was not in the original. And the reason we know that is none of the manuscripts before about the 7th century include that. So that doesn't create a question. 1 John 5, these three testify, the Spirit, the water, and the blood. I kind of wish that was actually in the original, but it wasn't. And then if you have the list of generally, we don't know for sure, this list is very, very short. Mark 16, 9 through 20. Apparently that part was probably not in the original Mark. How do we know that? Codex Sinaiticus, Codex Vaticanus don't include that. All right, but let's start thinking about that. The New Testament we have right now in Greek, it's been estimated somewhere between 99.9 and 99, depending on the scholar. Let's say 99.5. So the Greek New Testament we have is roughly 99.5% precise, as in no doubt or no significant doubt whatsoever. And the remaining 0.5% involves things about which it makes absolutely no distinction or difference whatsoever in any of the basic core beliefs in the New Testament. So why do people say this kind of stuff? I don't know. Talk to them. Let's talk about the canon. Let's talk about the list of books. And people would say, well, you know, they were fighting over this well into the 3rd and 4th century. Folks, that is simply not the case. It's not. So we have the Muratorian fragment for 170 A.D., and it lists all the New Testament books except, I believe it's Matthew. It's one of the Gospels, but it's a partial thing, so it was cut off. So we know by the second half of the second century A.D., essentially, with, I have to make a couple of small comments, essentially, by the second half of the second century A.D., the 27 books of the New Testament had already been selected as those which are inspired, which should be included in the New Testament. All right, here are the facts that we know from the evidence. By the 90s A.D., a group of letters of Paul had already been collected and were circulated together. Whether it contained all of Paul's letters in the 90s, somewhat debatable. For example, possibly 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus and Philemon were added to that collection a little bit later. Also by the 90s, we know this from the evidence, for example, of Clement of Rome quoting it, the four Gospels, exactly four, were already collected as a set and were being circulated in the churches by the 90s A.D. Marcion, a heretic in 140 A.D., he developed his own separate canon, and because he did that, New Testament, mainstream Christians started to develop, you know, writing down what the lists of were. Here's my summary, essentially. A still fluid but developing list of canonical books was being read by the church in the 150s A.D. There was still some doubt about 2nd and 3rd John, 2nd Peter, Hebrews, and Revelation. Not that anybody doubted they were inspired, but some people said definitely should be included. Others said we're not so sure. And by the end of the 2nd century, there was no change in the canon at all. A couple of books, some people were still discussing them, but they all had exactly the same list. Okay, so that's how the canon was chosen. It was chosen as those books which were by consensus known to be apostolic, which would mean were known that the apostles themselves say these were inspired. All right, some more information. Here's my summary then. The New Testament canon was selected by consensus of the church in the 2nd century BC as those books which had apostolic authority. The evidence is conclusive that the Greek New Testament we have is virtually identical to the original writings of the inspired writers, its accuracy being at least 99.5%, and no important biblical teachings at stake at all in the remaining 0.5% or so. Okay, what about the Old Testament? I don't have a lot of time because I want to talk about history and archaeology in the Bible, and I want to keep it down to about an hour. So I'm going to just spend a little bit of time talking about the Old Testament, the reliability of the Old Testament. I'll say this. We have a virtually perfect New Testament, which is almost exactly the same as the original. With the Old Testament, I would say we have a really good Hebrew Old Testament, which is very, very close to the original. But I'm not going to say almost exactly the same, because I think that would be overstating the case. And I think it's a mistake to overstate our evidence. Okay? So here's a piece of the Dead Sea Scrolls Psalms. Now, up until the 1940s, the evidence to support the Old Testament was very good, but not absolutely outstanding. We had, at that time, a few hundred manuscripts, but none of them were earlier than roughly the end of the 9th century AD. This is called the Masoretic Text. In about the 8th century AD, the Jews collected all the Hebrew text that they had, and they basically did an editorial thing and got together in groups and said, this, right now, this is the most reliable version in Hebrew we have, and then many, many copies were made from that. That's why almost all the later copies in Hebrew that we have are really similar to each other, which is sort of bad in a way, because that gives us less total evidence to go from in order to compare, like we can with the New Testament. You see a difference here, a difference there. You can say, well, almost certainly, using some textual criticism, that was the original. Got it? Now, the Jews were absolutely insane in their perfectionism in making copies. The Talmudists, this is in the 1st through 5th century, said a synagogue roll must be written on the skins of clean animals, prepared for the use of the synagogues by a Jew. They must be fastened together with strings taken from clean animals. And the list goes on and on and on. I'll post this at my website so you can kind of look at the craziness. And then there was the Masoretes. The Masoretes knew the middle verse of the entire Old Testament. They knew the middle word of the entire Old Testament. They knew the middle letter of the entire Old Testament. They knew how many times every single Hebrew letter was found in the Old Testament. They knew the middle letter of each book. They knew the middle word of each book. And if they made a copy, if there was a single mistake in the entire manuscript, they would burn it. These guys were crazy. They were, think of your most perfectionist you ever met. And these guys were an order of magnitude beyond that. Nevertheless, there's that annoying gap from the Old Testament being completed around 400 BC to our oldest text around 900 AD, somewhat annoying 1,300 or even more with some of the Old Testament books gap. But that was filled largely with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So there was about a 1,400-year gap, which, let's be honest, a fair amount of change could have happened over that time. Let's just be honest. Okay, but then, of course, you're probably aware of the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's cave number 4 near Qumran. They found hundreds and hundreds of manuscripts, about 30% or so of which were Old Testament manuscripts, also writings of the Essenes. Here's a picture of one of three Isaiah scrolls. Two were complete. One was nearly complete. Now, this graph kind of helps out. So here is where the, let's say the Old Testament was complete. Here is the oldest manuscript we had, 1,400 years. Now, the Dead Sea Scrolls come from roughly 250 BC to about 50 AD. Let's take the midpoint. Let's say 150 BC. What that does is it uses up about 80% of the gap. So what about the other 20%? Well, what you can do is you can compare the Dead Sea Scroll Isaiah to the Masoretic Text Isaiah. And in the entire book of Isaiah, they made something like 8 minor changes to the Hebrew text. Changes, yes. And like I said, our Hebrew Old Testament is an excellent version of the original, but I would not say nearly perfect. Copying is a problem. Copying numbers in Hebrews is very problematic. I don't have time to get into all that. So we have the Masoretic text from 800 AD, the Dead Sea Scrolls from 250 BC to 850 AD. We also have the Septuagint. Now, the Septuagint is a translation from the Hebrew into Greek somewhere before 200 BC. So it's like a snapshot. This, I'm telling you, this provides excellent additional evidence. Because let's say you wanted to know what I looked like when I was born. Well, let's say you had a snapshot of when I was 2 years old. That would give you a much better idea what I looked like when I was born than what I look like right now. That's what basically the Septuagint is. All right? And we have Septuagint. In fact, the Codex Sinaiticus and Alexandrinus include not only the entire Greek New Testament, they also include the Septuagint, the entire Greek Old Testament. All right? And that gives other evidence. Now, there are problems in copying from the Greek. Because like with the Greek, it's letter. But on top of that, it doesn't even include vowels. And copying of numbers is very problematic. So, for example, you see the Hebrew letter Keleth and the Hebrew letter Resh written by hand are pretty similar. So fairly often those would get switched. The letters he and heth, also very similar. So you could see in copying there could be mistakes. Also the copying of numbers. For example, American versus American. Which is the right one? Obviously American, because American is not a word. Is it 510 or 51? I don't know. I can't tell from looking at that. So numbers are hard. All right? So nevertheless, the Old Testament we have, based on evidence from the Septuagint. Also, we have the Samaritan Pentateuch from 400 BC. We have the Old Testament, the first five books, translated into the Samaritan language, 400 BC. And also, we have quotes, the Targums, where the Jews would quote extensively from the Old Testament. All of these gives us really good evidence for the reliability of the Hebrew text. Then there's the Hebrew canon. The Hebrew canon was chosen by the scribes and the teachers of the law. We don't know exactly how. We don't know the process, but we can say this. By roughly 200 BC, the entire Old Testament canon was set. There's the famed Council of Jamnia in 79 AD, but that was just confirming the canon. That was already around. Now, some people say, well, what about the Old Testament Apocrypha? Well, the fact is the Jews never used the Apocrypha not to be canonical. Anyway, a lot can be said about that. If you have some questions, we can come back to that. But I've basically given you more evidence to trust the reliability of the New Testament. So I want to talk about history, archaeology, and the Bible. Because I believe if we look at some of these things, you're going to be given a lot of confidence in the reliability of the Old Testament. So a lot of people say, I'm going to skip all these things here, the Apocrypha. We could talk about the Apocrypha, how it really shows in so many ways the reliability of the Old Testament. We could talk about Bible contradictions. I don't have time for all that. We can come back to that if you want, because I'm going to talk about history, archaeology, and the Bible. All right, now, a lot of people would say that we don't really know for sure whether David ever lived, and the story of Moses, who's Abraham, how can you believe that? You know, how do we know the Jews were ever even in Egypt? These are a bunch of stories, a bunch of fables. These things were all written around 500 BC, 400 BC, 300 BC. And basically, the essential premises of the Old Testament, which are based on, yes, Abraham is a real person, and yes, he really was a man of faith, and yes, he really is the father of the Jews, that these things are really, nobody can believe it. These are not even reliable at all. All right, well, I want to talk about that just a little bit. By the way, if we have a time frame from ancient times up to, say, 400 BC or so, when should you start to see actual things you can dig up which would reflect what we find in the Old Testament? The answer is probably after about 1000 BC, because that's when the Jews started to be a political power, to have cities and monuments. Before about 1000 BC, the evidence supporting the Old Testament is going to be somewhat indirect. So you're not going to find cities of Jews in Egypt during Moses' time because the Jews were in utter poverty. You're not going to find a proof of Abraham from 1900 BC because who was Abraham? He lived in a tent. He didn't build huge monuments. But I believe we're going to see plenty of evidence supporting the general reliability of the Old Testament from archaeological evidence. So here's Ur. If you read Genesis, you see that Abraham was born in Ur, and Ur is presented as a large and prosperous city that Abraham and his family left. From there, they went to Haran. Haran has more the feel of a sort of a pioneer outpost on the edge of Mesopotamia, leading to areas outside of Mesopotamia proper. Well, it turns out both Ur and Haran have been found, and in fact, Ur was a large city, probably the largest city in Mesopotamia at that time, very prosperous. Also, Haran has been found. Interestingly, Haran was destroyed somewhere around 1400 BC and never occupied as a city under that name ever again. Now, the critics of the Old Testament, its reliability as history, would say, you know, Genesis wasn't written until 500 BC, maybe 600 BC. By then, the city of Haran had not even existed for 700 or 800 years. So how would they have known of this city? Well, we know about this city because we can go there and we can find it and dig up its ruins. But if this was just a story made up by Jews living in Palestine 800 years later, how would they even have known about this city, Haran? Here are the Eblat tablets. Now, if you look at the Eblat tablets, the city of Eblat would be in, we would call it Syria today. Somewhere, so you have Palestine here, you have Mesopotamia here. Eblat would be up here, kind of in the region around Syria, not too far from where Lebanon is. They found tens of thousands of tablets from Eblat. And most of them are mundane things, tax records, property records, things like that. But amongst these tablets, several names were found. Nahor, Terug, Abram, Sarai. So what does this prove? What this proves is Nahor, Terug, Abram, Sarai, which are names found in Genesis, which is supposedly from around 1800 to 2000 BC, these tablets show that those were common names. By the way, these are not the biblical characters. They're not. What this shows is these were common names in Upper Mesopotamia in the year around 2000 BC, which is the time frame for when these Eblat tablets were actually created. Now, if, as the critics would say, there was no such person as Abraham, this is just a story written, you know, 1,300 years later from people who had no even cultural contact with ancient Samaria or ancient Babylonia. Well, how would they have known that these were common names? It's kind of like, let's say I read a letter and you know, somebody said, yeah, this person is a friend of mine, sent me this letter. It mentions Gertrude and Harold. You go, no, that doesn't make any sense because nobody's called Gertrude or Harold. It's kind of like that. There's an interesting scene in Genesis where when Jacob leaves with Leah and Rachel, and his father-in-law chases him down, not to get his daughter back, but to get the household gods back. They're like, what's that about? Well, they found a document from Mesopotamia from around 2000 BC saying that those who hold the household gods get the inheritance. Ah. So what we have here is the evidence says that the book of Genesis fits the context not of Palestine in 500 BC, it fits the historical and cultural context of Mesopotamia around 2000 BC, and there's plenty more evidence of it than that. Okay, what about Sodom and Gomorrah? Now, if you go to Genesis 14:2, you can read about this battle. There were five large cities in the region of the Dead Sea, and they had in league with Lot, fought a battle with Chedorlaomer from Elam, and then Abraham went and rescued and Lot's stuff and all that. Well, the thing is, if you go to the Dead Sea today, it is truly the Dead Sea. And there, if you look around, there's no evidence for ancient cities. In fact, it is so desolate that until fairly recently, no archaeologists had done any digging in the area. And again, the critics of the Bible have been saying for 100 years, this story about Sodom and Gomorrah, right, sure. You know, fire and brimstone. I mean, just go to the Dead Sea and tell me that's a true story. In fact, in the book of Genesis, Abraham is in the hill country around where Jerusalem would be, and he sends Lot down for the really good agricultural land by the Dead Sea. Well, anyway, somebody finally decided, let's do a little digging around. What they found is these wadis. These are essentially dry canyons, which today, maybe once every year or two, there'll be a big thunderstorm, and then they're dry up immediately. Useless for farming. But it turns out, in the year 2200 BC, give or take a couple hundred years, there was extensive farming using irrigation in around the Dead Sea. Now, this was not an area, it was not a wet area, it was quite dry, but there was enough rainfall back then that these wadis, instead of being, you know, flowing for 2 days out of a year, they flowed most of the year, and there was extensive agriculture. And guess what? They found cities. Guess how many cities they found? You guessed it. Five cities, the largest of which, Bab Edrah, almost certainly would be the biblical Sodom. Outside of Bab Edrah, and by the way, I believe here are some of the ruins from what was Sodom, which is a real city. And by the way, all five cities were destroyed by fire around 2100 BC, and none of them were ever occupied again. In fact, the entire area was essentially abandoned for human population. Outside of the city, outside of Sodom, there was a graveyard, and it had wooden buildings, and the evidence was the wooden buildings had been burned from the top to the bottom. Normally, when you burn down a city or buildings, you burn them from the bottom to the top. These were burned from the top to the bottom. And proof, a little too far, I would say, but here seems to be evidence of the destruction of the five cities. The five cities, including Sodom, Gomorrah, Zeboim, and others. Okay. Another thing has to do with the Hittites. Hittites are mentioned many times in the Old Testament. Something like 67 times the Hittites are mentioned. Including even, throughout Genesis and Joshua and Judges. But in the 19th century, critics of the Bible would say Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Jebusites, Girgashites, whatever. Come on, give me a break. There's no evidence that any of these people ever existed. It's just pure fantasy. But then in 1906, Hugo Winkler discovered the city of Hattusha, which is a large city. And what they found out eventually is that Hattusha was the capital of the Hittite Empire, which controlled almost all of what we'd call Turkey today, as well as large parts of northern Syria. In fact, it was the chief rival to Egypt at the time of Moses, and even in late times of the patriarchs. All right, and here's the city gate of Hattusha. So, you know, now when I read about the Girgashites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, and the Hittites, you know what? I'm beginning to think probably these are real. In fact, there are a couple of universities where you can actually major in Hittite studies. So I'm starting to believe this might actually be a real thing. All right, so what about the Exodus and from Egypt and then the conquering of Canaan? Now, I'm going to tell you this. We do not have actual physical objects we can hold which are proof of the Israelites being in Egypt. The reason is they were extremely poor people that would leave only huts and maybe some fireplaces behind. We also don't have proof of the wandering in the desert because what would you find? A campsite? Footprints? How would you know? All right. But we do have some interesting evidence. For example, the Tel El Amarna tablets. These are found in the city of El Amarna, which was built around 1400 BC, which fits the time frame perfectly. For the Exodus and the conquest. And in amongst hundreds of tablets was this one here. It says, "The Habiru plunder all the lands of the king. If archers are here this year, then the lands of the king, the Lord, will remain. But if archers are not here, then the lands of the king, my Lord, are lost." Who do you think these Habiru just possibly might be? Could they be the Hebrews? Could it be that these are minor kings in Palestine, in the Promised Land, who are writing to Pharaoh saying, people from outside, these Hebrews are attacking us, and if you don't help us out, they're going to conquer large parts of our territory? Yeah, I think so. In fact, I think we know what happened, which is that Pharaoh did not send enough help, and in fact, large parts of both northern and southern Israel were conquered during that time. All right, here's the stele of Merneptah from 1230 BC. In other words, this stele specifically mentions the Jews and Israel in the Promised Land from the 13th century BC. You have to understand, before something like this is found, the atheists, the skeptics, they would deny that there even was a nation of Israel before maybe 800 BC. Here's the thing. Every time we find a new archaeological thing, these critics, these atheists, these skeptics say, all right, well, maybe that's true, but this, and this, none of these things are true. Then you find, well, that was true. They go, okay, fine, but these things are still not true. At some point, what they probably should do is admit this, which is that the Bible is by far the most reliable book of history we have from the ancient world, without exception. In other ancient histories, the kings never lost a battle. If you read the records of Sennacherib or Nebuchadnezzar, these guys never lost a battle. If you read Jewish history, did the Jews ever lose any of their battles? Yeah, like they lost more than they won. The Old Testament is very reliable history. All right. By the way, Jericho has been extensively excavated. And it's a very complex excavation because Jericho has been around for about 10,000 years. But they found evidence of a destruction of Jericho from around 1400 BC, a massive destruction. And when this destruction happened, the walls collapsed. And there's evidence of a very short siege because they found remnants of grain in some of the storehouses from that time. One of the criticisms of the Old Testament, they would say, you know, if you read the book of Joshua, it's like they're conquering all of Palestine from this time, and yet there's almost no cities destroyed at that time. By the way, it's true. There were very few cities destroyed in the late 15th century BC, but it just so happens that according to Joshua, only Ai, Hatzor, and Jericho were destroyed. All the other cities were simply occupied. And it turns out, guess which two large cities from Palestine were destroyed at that time. Hatzor and Jericho. Now, Ai has not been identified yet, but I'll tell you this, for I just guarantee you, if they ever discover for sure which of the hills in Palestine was Ai, that it would have been destroyed and burned in 1400 BC. I would bet my life on it. All right, so here's the Moabite stone. This one's interesting. It's found in the Louvre. It's by the way, you don't find these kinds of stelae in Israel, and you don't find statues. You don't find statues of David or Jeroboam or you know, Ahab. The reason is, in the Old Testament, God says, don't make these kinds of things. So it's kind of unfortunate for us, but luckily for us, we have things from outside of Israel that provides pretty good support to the Old Testament. So this is the Moabite stone found in Moab, of course. It's now in the Louvre. It comes from 870 BC, a time when 100 years ago they would say the Jews may not even have existed. And it mentions Ahab of the house of Omri. Turns out Jeroboam, northern kingdom, David, southern kingdom. Jeroboam's line died out, so a new dynasty came, which was begun by Omri. So you know what? I'm thinking Ahab's a real person. I'm thinking Omri's a real person. And there was a whole dynasty founded based on Omri. Okay, here's one of my favorite, the Tel Dan inscription. This comes from Tel Dan, which is a city in Galilee, northeast of the Sea of Galilee, near Caesarea Philippi. A good friend of mine, John Wilson, was in the city of Dan the day this was discovered. And he tells me that he actually walked by this rock. What it was is, it's kind of a wall of the city. What they would do is, the cities would be destroyed, and they rebuild the city. They would just take stones and just rebuild it. And this was just sort of randomly in the wall. So this was put in that wall much, much later. But it's interesting what it says here. This is a boast by the king of Aram. All right. And here's what he says. Let me see if I got the quote. All right. He says, I killed Jehoram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, and I killed Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, king of the house of David. All right. That's pretty interesting, I would say. Pretty cool. Now, by the way, this confirms 2 Kings 8:28 and 29. But actually, if you read 2 Kings 8:28 and 29, it says that actually the Aram king did not kill Ahab. Actually, he injured Ahab. Ahab escaped from the battle, and Jehu killed Ahab. Now, I've got a very simple question. Which is more believable, the account of Hatzael, who made the Tel Dan inscription, or the biblical account about how Ahab died? My answer to that is, it's really obvious. It's really obvious that the account in the Old Testament is more reliable, because the Old Testament is always as or more reliable than any other source that we have. And there are no exceptions. So why do people still doubt the reliability of, say, of Moses, or the Exodus, or Abraham, or Isaac, or Jacob? I would say, well, they have to answer that for themselves. Okay, now here's an interesting one. This is the black obelisk of Shalmaneser. Again, I said, we don't have these kinds of engravings and bas relief in Israel because it seems to be one of the few laws that God gave, and they actually followed fairly well. But if you read the inscription below this, I actually took the picture on the right because it's in the British Museum. And if you look closely there, you can see this guy in the middle, and that's the equivalent of what you have over there on the left and also down below. And according to the description, that is King Jehu. And according to the description, that is King Jehu bowing down to Shalmaneser. Now, the Old Testament does not specifically mention Jehu going to Nineveh or wherever it would have been, and actually bowing and giving obeisance to Shalmaneser. And in fact, it's possible that this is symbolic. In other words, this represents the fact that Israel submitted to Assyria. We don't really know one way or another. But we do know that 2 Kings 17:3-6 says that essentially that Jehu paid tribute to Shalmaneser. So, you know, I think I believe Jehu's a real guy, which kind of ties into the Tel Dan inscription. The Sennacherib Cylinder, this is one of my favorites. It's in the British Museum. It looks huge, but it's actually only about this big. It's the tiniest writing. And here Sennacherib is boasting. So Sennacherib is one of the next kings after Shalmaneser. All right, so here we go. This is the Sennacherib Cylinder. If you read in 2 Kings 18, you read the story about Sennacherib coming with this massive Assyrian army, conquering all the cities of Judea. This is about 691 BC. By now, the northern kingdom's already been wiped out, coming and surrounding Jerusalem. So here is Sennacherib boasting about this campaign in which he says, I laid siege to 46 of Hezekiah's cities, his forts, and countless small villages. I drove out of them 200,000 people, young and old, male and female. Himself, Hezekiah, I made a prisoner in Jerusalem, his royal residence, like a bird in a cage. So what he says is, essentially, I put Jerusalem under siege. End of story. Why does the story there end? Why is it that the largest, most powerful army in the world didn't finish the siege of Jerusalem? Well, read 2 Kings 18. You'll find that 170,000 troops were killed that very night. And I believe that we have here not direct evidence of the miraculous intervention of God, but I'd say here, in the quote from Sennacherib, we have indirect evidence of the miraculous intervention of God helping Hezekiah. And, you know, you can read about that in 2 Kings and also in Isaiah. The Siloam inscription, this is really cool. If you read in 2 Kings 20, it mentions that they built a tunnel. So in order to prepare for the siege that was coming from Sennacherib, their water source is from outside the city, well outside the city, near the northern part, near the city of David. So they built a tunnel, something around 3/4 mile long. This is a huge tunnel, an amazing architectural feat. And they dug from both ends and they met in the middle. All right. That's what it says in 2 Kings 18. Well, they found the tunnel. The tunnel actually leads to the Pool of Siloam. That's why it's called the Siloam inscription. And sure enough, it's an inscription that's not there, by the way. I've gone through the tunnel. They've taken that out. It's the story about when they met and what happened there. Okay, the destruction of Lachish. I'm running out of time here. Israeli captives being led from Lachish. I think this really happened. This is recorded in Jeremiah. All right, the Lachish letters, 588 BC. If you read in Jeremiah 34, verse 6 and 7, it says, it's somebody basically saying, you destroyed Azekah, and then Lachish, and then later on he came and laid siege to Jerusalem. And this letter, which was found right at the city gate of Lachish, basically it's a guy who's writing a letter hoping to send it to Jerusalem so that it could get military support, because he says the light in Azekah just went out. If you don't send us military support, we will be conquered very, very soon. Well, we know what happened, because the city was destroyed and this shard was found at the city gate, just like it says in Jeremiah 34, verse 6 and 7. Okay, we could talk about the Babylonian Chronicles. Here, if you read in Jeremiah, it talks about Jehoiachin was taken off to the city of Babylon and treated like a king. We have an actual list of the supplies used to take care of Jehoiachin. His name is on that document, and he was given 5 times more provisions than any of the other people. He was given kingly treatment. Amen. Last one. So this is from Daniel chapter 5. In Daniel chapter 5, what you have here is this guy, Belshazzar, offering to Daniel the third highest place in the kingdom if he can read the writing written on the wall. The problem with this is ancient historians of ancient history would tell us there was no such king as Belshazzar in Babylon. The last king of Babylon was Nabonidus. Everybody knows that. Herodotus agrees. Thucydides agrees. All the ancient historians agree the last king of Babylon was Nabonidus. And yet in Daniel, well, you know, it's just a story. I mean, nobody really believes Daniel in the lion's den, obviously. Just a bunch of stories made up. But Daniel mentions this guy Belshazzar. Well, they found it in scripture in the ziggurat in Ur, which explained what happens. Nabonidus had a coup in which he murdered evil Merodach, and essentially he took the throne. But he was not of the royal family. So therefore, what he did was he married Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. And through that relationship, they produced Belshazzar. And Belshazzar ruled as the regent king. This daughter of Nebuchadnezzar is the one you find as a character in Daniel chapter 5. All right, so this does two things. First of all, it explains why it is that Daniel has Belshazzar ruling, because we know from the record here in Ur that Nabonidus was off. He left almost the entire administration of the entire Babylon to his son, and was off doing some bunch of stuff. So this explains, first of all, that Daniel is right, all of the other ancient historians were wrong, but it also explains why Belshazzar offered Daniel the third highest place in the kingdom. It's not explained in Daniel, but we can go to the ziggurat in Ur and we find out, it's because Belshazzar had the second highest place in the kingdom. So to summarize what we have here is, I'm telling you folks, we can trust the Old Testament and the New Testament to be reliable in terms of the documents we read from which they're translated. And in turn, we can believe that the events in the Old Testament really happened. Now, I cannot prove that David killed Goliath with just one shot. There's no way we can prove everything. But every single time we find historical evidence, it always supports the Old Testament. And these skeptics, these critics, they're just never going to admit it. They're just never going to admit it. But I'm telling you, the Old Testament is by far the most reliable document of ancient history we have, period. All right, so tonight, I think it's at 8. Somebody can mention that. I'm going to do what's going to be my favorite thing. We're going to talk about Jesus and evidence for Jesus. Can we do Q&A? I'm open to that if you want. Got a bunch more slides here I didn't have time to go over.
Yes.
Hopefully that was helpful. As far as I'm concerned, everybody can turn their mics on, but I'll let Mackie decide there.
I'm going to mute and go to my other.
Thanks, Sean. That was awesome.
Oh, thanks. I had to cover a lot in short time. Sorry about that. Was I talking too fast? I think I was.
No, it was perfect tempo for me.
That's because you're a young person.
No, that was great. And just so everyone knows, we have this recorded, so this will go up on our YouTube. We can get that going.
It'll be at my website also. Maybe, like, when's Seattle going to get a basketball team? Oh, man, open sore time, huh?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Good thing I'm a hockey fan.
Yeah. Do they have a hockey team in Washington?
They're getting one.
It's funny. We have, like, three hockey teams in California, and people don't even play hockey in California. They don't even skate. People skate in Washington.
Yeah. on the participant window or just hop on in and unmute yourself? And...
Yeah, just go for it.
Yep, here we go. We got one right next to me.
Hey, I read this once, and I'm curious if you can confirm if it's true or not. I read that during the parting of the Red Sea, that they found evidence of chariot wheels found downriver, Egyptian chariot wheels. Is that true?
No, unfortunately, there's this guy, and he's very, very disreputable. And this guy, the same person claimed to have found Noah's Ark and stuff like that. And that is just completely bogus. I hate to say it. No, in fact, that was actually essentially faked data. I'm forgetting the guy's name. A friend of mine, Rex Geisler, actually talked to this guy because Rex, he's done a bunch of stuff on Mount Ararat. He's come across him. And he asked him, why do you do this kind of stuff? Why do you create this fake data? It's giving Christianity a bad name. And the guy said, well, I have to make a living somehow. So sad to say, I would not use that at all. It's not reliable. Okay. Anything related to, you know, the Ark, all this stuff is either bogus or there's really no evidence. So we should use reliable kinds of information. Thanks for asking. Yeah, like I said, there is, as of this date, there's no actual physical evidence that you can say for sure, this is from Israel either when they were in Egypt or during the Exodus. There is none. However, of course, we have the Tel El Amarna letters, correct? Right? And we also have the evidence from the destruction of Hazor and Jericho.
Well, so oddly enough, I was going to ask a very similar question. So John really took the wind out of my sails on that.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, that's great. I would rather have some expert truth on the matter as opposed to going off onto a tangent. So let me change the question a little bit. I was just going to mute myself and go away. But let me phrase it this way. What is some of the most exciting new evidence within, like, maybe the last 5 years, 10 years, because I know that archaeology is just uncovering so many things right now in that area. What are you most excited about?
I used to read Biblical Archaeology Review and stay on top of all that stuff. But in the last 5 or 10 years, I've tended to kind of go off in other areas. There's the Caiaphas ossuary, which was discovered. So this is almost certainly the bone box of Caiaphas himself, who is the high priest at that time. They found Baruch. They found a scarab from Baruch. And Baruch, this is almost certainly the same Baruch who was the secretary to Jeremiah. Remember when the king was cutting up the manuscript and throwing it into the fire? That Baruch. That's a couple. My brain's not working right now. There has been some pretty good stuff in the last few years. I don't know why, but my brain's not working very well right now.
Oh, that's fine. Thank you very much.
I have to go to my own website. Oh, yeah. Archaeology. But anyway, there's the Gabriel Stone, which seems to not so much talk about the New Testament, but it talks about some of the things that were believed by the church in the first century AD, the Gabriel Stone. There was this find in certain burial mass they found in Egypt, and basically papier-mâché. So somebody thought, let's take those papier-mâché chunks and see what's on them, because generally what they do is when you make paper mache, even now, you take newspaper, stuff like that. And so they found what they thought was probably little tiny pieces of the book of Mark from about 70 or 80 AD. Well, the problem is, you know, there is some debate about whether this is legitimate or not. First of all, whether it really is actually little tiny pieces of Mark and whether they really are actually from 70 or 80 AD. Probably the date between 70 and 80 AD is solid. Whether or not these pieces of Mark is sufficiently in question that I don't put it in print. I believe it's very likely we have little tiny, tiny fragments of Mark from the first century. However, you won't find anything about that at my website, simply because until I see really solid confirmation, I don't write about it because I want to be careful. There's the famous James ossuary from about, this is now old, it's probably about 20 years old now. Supposedly they found this bone box of James, the brother of Jesus. And a lot of people wrote about it, got all excited about it. I purposely held back on writing about it because I just had a feeling I wanted to wait for some more confirmation, even though it was in the Biblical Archaeology Review. And sure enough, within about a year, there's some evidence that this thing was a fake. It was literally a fake, which is really, really sad. So, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like Nicole, you have a question, or someone in your family?
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much. It's been such great teaching all day today. I appreciate your time.
Sure.
And I did have a question about the ziggurat.
Yeah.
That was in Ur. Was that something that they dug up, or is there still remnants of the ziggurat?
Oh, it's still, well, that's, you saw an actual picture. It is in excellent shape. I wasn't there when they did the excavation, but I would assume part of it was sticking up above the ground still. I don't know that as an absolute fact. In the case of Babylon, the city of Babylon was entirely buried when they dug it up. All right, Ur is southeast from Babylon, probably maybe, maybe 60 or 80 miles southeast of Babylon. I believe that part of that ziggurat was actually visible. It's huge. They didn't make pyramids like in Egypt. They made these ziggurats, which were kind of like sort of like stepped pyramids, and probably the Tower of Babel would have looked something like the ziggurat in Ur. So anyway, no, it's not like Babylon, which was dug up in the 19th century, or I believe that was well known from a long time. Another important one is Nineveh, and it wasn't until the late 19th century that Nineveh was even discovered. So if you read skeptics of the Bible from the mid and late 1900s, they'll say Nineveh is not a real place, and you know Daniel, where he goes around 7 days to go through the city and all that sort of stuff, a bunch of nonsense. But actually, Nineveh was a massive city with a very, very thick wall.
Anyone else have any other questions?
You could.
Yeah, I got one.
Go as broad as you want on this, a Bible question if you want. But all right, Ben. Okay.
So just about like the ancient Chinese, sometimes when I, reach out to people, they talk about, well, Chinese history predates, even the Old Testament kind of thing. And I just wanted to see what you thought about as far as how those texts or whatever manuscripts or whatever that culture has compared to like some of the other manuscripts in history that you talked about with Old Testament and New Testament history.
Well, there's China's a different case, say from Egypt, say from Mesopotamia, Anatolia, say Stonehenge in England. Everything is different. there's pretty good evidence that the most ancient cities and civilizations were, in fact, from the Middle East. All right, and so in southern Turkey and northern Mesopotamia, there's evidence of actual cities from 10,000 BC, long before any concept of what was going on in China. Now, with China, the kinds of archaeological evidence that are available are much, much less than, say, in the Middle East and in Egypt. So, the famous thing with the buried soldiers there from the Qin Dynasty, right, in China, that's not 2000 BC. That's more like, sorry, I'm going to mess up, like 100 BC, somewhere around there. Let's just say this. Absolutely, there's no question about it. There was an advanced civilization in the Yangtze River, in China, 2000 BC. Probably the civilization in the Indus River, which would be Pakistan today. We get the name India comes from. Mohenjo-Daro. We have actual excavations in India that are older than any excavations we have from China. And the excavations we have from Egypt are older than Mohenjo-Daro. And then some of those in southern Turkey and northern Mesopotamia are even older. So, but what we don't have is written records from China 2000 BC. We simply don't have it. It just doesn't even exist. And yet what we do have is like the Code of Hammurabi, right? The Babylonian legal code from 2000 BC. And we have Egyptian inscriptions from 2500 BC. So the earliest records of things we could call history are coming from the Middle East and Egypt, not from China.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
Sorry if you guys heard a train. We live right next to the train track.
Oh, I forgot there's a train there.
Yeah.
Is that by the river? Oh, Cheney. Okay. Oh, it's Cheney? I thought it was Cheney. All right, Cheney. I remember Cheney.
Yeah. But, awesome. Does anyone else have any questions? I'll look
around. Bible question from this morning.
Oh, we got another one right here.
Sorry to double dip. I'm really curious. Is there any information on the origins of the Book of Job or the Land of Uz?
No. No. Job is a fairly mysterious book, and attempts at putting a place and a time for it are probably going to be not fruitful. The impression that I get from the book of Job is perhaps even predating Abraham himself. I would say this: Job was certainly not a Jew, right? He's definitely not a Jew. And, you know, there are elements of Job that sound almost like a parable. All right? And so, I don't know exactly what to think about Job. I'm convinced it's inspired by God. It's got the most advanced sort of concept of theodicy in the entire Bible, the rule of God and God's sovereignty and how that interacts with our free will, and the philosophy and all that is in Job. It's clearly inspired. But unlike Genesis beginning in chapter 12, Genesis up to chapter 11 is kind of prehistory, honestly. Before Abraham, anything before Abraham in Genesis, we can't put a definite place or time on it, okay? I would say the same thing with Job. Job, like Genesis before Abraham, we don't know the time or the place. You can read a commentary on Job, and they're gonna guess. But honestly, they're gonna probably admit it's a guess. All right. So, my reading of Job is that he is from roughly the time frame of Abraham, possibly even from before Abraham. And he is a a believer in Jehovah who is not a Jew. That would be like Melchizedek, right? Melchizedek was not Jewish. Melchizedek was a contemporary of Abraham. And so clearly we have some evidence that that Abraham and Terah and these guys weren't the only ones who believed in this one God, this, you know, that left polytheism but believed in this one God that we call Jehovah. They may have called him El. So I can't help you with Job. If I could, I would.
I didn't think you could, but I was curious if you had any new stuff to come out.
I've read about it. I've read commentaries and stuff. And I conclude that we don't know. So I'd rather just say we don't know. I would say almost certainly Abraham or earlier.
Awesome. Any other questions?
So where is Uz? Is that near Oz? I think in Annie's house, Annie McCune's house, I saw a hand up there. I'm drinking my coffee, so I got lots of energy. We can see you guys at 8?
Yes, 8 p.m. Is the next class.
That's my favorite of the three.
Website. It is a new Zoom call, so two different recordings and two different links. So
am I going to need a new Zoom call when I come in at 7:30?
Yes, I'll send that to you as well.
Great.
But thanks everyone for coming. Log back in 8 o'clock or just before.
We'll see you all then.
Five. So, thank you.
Yep.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, John.
You bet, Bryce.
Send you the link right now. I'll work on that.
Great. Any feedback about either the teaching or just the physical layout or anything like that?
What was that?
Any feedback, things we could do better? Sound, lighting, my teaching, the interaction, whatever?
No, I thought it went good. I thought everything was smooth. And, if you set up the presentation mode just like we did, I think that worked out great.
Great. All right. Thanks.
Awesome. See you tonight.
Yep. Oh, I better stop sharing, huh? Give you back control.